once more into the breach, though, dear friends.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead. We're reversing this. We are.
I did this for a month with you off enjoying the beautiful Colorado weather. You came back to this beautiful Texas weather.
Well, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another second hour episode of The Personal Wealth Coach on this September 22nd, first day of autumn.
I think it's a little misleading to say boys and girls.
There could be boys and girls listening. I mean,
told you what happens?
You're riding along in the car, and there's boys and girls in the back seat.
They are complaining at this point and saying, change the channel. These guys are boring.
It depends on how compliant they are.
See, I have a 3-year-old daughter who loves me.
Yes.
When I left this morning to come to the radio studio, she hugged and kissed me lots and lots and lots
but
of times.
But she still didn't want to listen to the radio show.
She'll want to listen. Here's what happens. Mama, can we listen to Daddy on the radio? Radio comes on. Half a minute later, okay, no more. So,
what does that mean?
Ladies and gentlemen, the boys and girls are gone already.
I'm still going to say ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, because this is a quote from the old-time radio. I also use my radio voice. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. See, I have to use my old-time radio voice.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, which not coincidentally is the same name as an investment advisory firm doing family wealth management in Salado, Texas. And the telephone number in here at KTEM, if today is September 22nd, it's still the telephone number, but if you want to talk to us in today's September 22nd, 2018, you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. And ask us any questions, make any comments about anything to do with investing or the economy. Those are the actually fiscal, financial, or economic questions, thoughts, or comments.
Right. And I have a email actually right now.
Okay.
From Ken. Ken said the Supreme Court is not always pro-law. I agree.
Whoa!
I agree.
Why?
It's not always pro-law.
It is the law.
It is the law, but it's not always pro-written law. And I agree, Ken. I need to go back and listen to the recording, was that the Supreme Court should not be making up law on the bench. It should be enforcing laws written and ruling on that. Hopefully that's the position going forward. It isn't always pro-law. That is correct. We have a lot of rulings that have been overturned over the years. What are you growling about?
Well, the Supreme Court ultimately sets the law. The legislatures pass a law, and if it's unconstitutional or if it conflicts with another law.
To the highest law, right.
The highest law. What's the highest law?
Constitution. If the rights under the Constitution are violated by a lower law, then the Supreme Court, the highest court, says, nope, the highest law supersedes the lowest law.
You got it. And
well, that's what they're supposed to do anyway. Well, sometimes they say this is a new interpretation of the Constitution.
But the Constitution gives them the authority to do that.
That's what their job is, yeah.
And then that's an interesting point, by the way, folks. The Supreme Court may pass a judgment and say, here is the meaning of this law. But the legislature has the ability to go back and redo the law then.
Absolutely.
At that point. And if it is the Supreme Court saying, hey, the Constitution clearly says, this is what the Supreme Court basically says, that this is the law, and the law that Congress passed is in violation of the Constitution. Well, Congress and the states then can pass an amendment to the Constitution and change the Constitution. But if Congress does not have the will
to do it, then we got to go back to what the Supreme Court said the interpretation of the Constitution.
Right, and that works pretty well.
In last hour, what we were talking about, specifically in relation to the Supreme Court, was immigration law, where the authority basically gave a citation to someone that they determined might be an illegal alien, and said, you've got to appear in court, but then didn't give the time and date. And if you look at any traffic citation that you get, which, by just as a side note, for those of you that don't look at this too much, it's the same level of violation as a traffic citation to be an illegal immigrant. If you get a traffic citation that doesn't say appear in court by this date, then it's not a valid citation. You do have to go to court. You do have to figure that out. You can't just not show up. But it's one of those things that you can talk to your attorney about, and the attorney can say, hey, this isn't a valid citation, and fight it on that ground. And that's what's happened. There wasn't even a slot for a date on the stationery to give the illegal immigrant citation.
And there's a reason for that.
Because the courts are backed up.
The courts are so backed up that in many cases they aren't even scheduling an appearance date because it would be like 5 or 6 years from now.
Right.
So they don't bother to put the date in there because there's no point in putting a date because there is no date.
Well, here's the thing, and this is true when you get a traffic citation. It says you've got to appear at court by this date. That's not going to be the date that you actually go to court, though. You show up, and then they schedule the date.
Right, but still, it gives you a date to show up.
Right, they didn't give a date to show up. So what the Supreme Court said is they looked at the law, and the law is the same law that has allowed the president to hold immigrants for long periods of time. So if you're a anti-immigration person, the law was very clearly written to have rule of law in it. Here's the process. You've got to show up at a given date, and then another date will be set. Well, that wasn't happening. So the Supreme Court said, who set the stationery? Whoever did that made a big mistake, and it's not usable.
And the other thing is, again, this is you need to put it back on Congress where it belongs, in the majority of Congress, and the budgetary scheduling in Congress belongs to the Republicans right now. And so ultimately, the reason the immigration system isn't working is twofold. One, the laws are really screwed up. Two, there's not enough courts and judges. Why is there not enough courts and judges? Because the Congress won't allocate the money for enough courts and judges to handle it.
Here's what we have done. We've allocated a lot of money to Border Patrol and ICE, which means that there's a lot more arrests happening. And we've put a few more judges in there, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. If you look at the number of thousands of immigration officers, whether at ICE or Border Patrol or any other capacity that's focused on immigration, you'll see that we have increased our
capacity
to grab them
to apprehend.
Up.
Capacity to apprehend.
It's not incarcerate. It's not arrest.
Right.
It's apprehend and document. We don't have the facilities to house them, as we have seen very clearly. And we have a caller on 773-1400.
All right.
We don't have the court capacity. Well, that doesn't mean that you just skip the court process. That's not how America works. Okay, so caller on 773-1400, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you.
It seems like every day in the Wall Street Journal, there's more companies buying other companies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm on the mega...
Part of the cycle. It's called the M&A.
The mega mergers, I guess, have to go through SEC or somebody.
The Justice Department.
Okay.
The Antitrust Division of the Justice Department.
At what level deal does that happen, and what's kind of the process? I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Good call.
Well, first, somebody has to
be referred.
Has to issue get lawyered up and issue a complaint to the Justice Department saying, hey, We think this is going to stifle competition, and generally, if it's going to stifle competition, the competition will file the complaint.
Right.
And
if
then
you
the
think
justice,
back to the old browser battles, so let's go back to Internet Explorer versus what was the there were Firefox and a lot of other browsers, because Microsoft had a big chunk of the computer market, and they were including on their computers a Microsoft browser, Internet Explorer. They now call it Edge. Although Internet Explorer still works, you can go back and get it. It's not the most secure anymore. So all of their competition came back and said, whoa, wait a minute, you are knocking us out of the playing field. We can't compete against you because you've already got programmed into the computer a program that's not us. So there was a big back and forth on the antitrust side, and Microsoft was said, all right, you can't make it the only browser that works on your machine.
Yeah, and then after all these guys got through fighting, then Google came along that wasn't even involved in the fight and dominated everybody. And
now it made a search engine and then a browser on top of it.
And now the European Union and the Justice Department are investigating Google for being a monopoly.
Right. One of the
because it's too good.
Yeah. One of the fascinating aspects here. Microsoft had a lot of antitrust movement against it. Bill Gates, in the height of this era, when Microsoft dominated everything computers, Apple was dying. It was disappearing. They had just hired Steve Jobs back from Pixar, which he'd gone off and founded because Apple had kicked him out. Steve Jobs came back to Apple.
Next.
Next what?
He was in Next. That was the name of the software company he had founded.
Okay. And Pixar. Pixar was a big chunk of that. So he came back, was back at Apple, and Apple was still failing. They had no capital. They had no money for reinvestment. And Bill Gates bought $100 million personally of non-voting Apple shares. Now, at the time, non-voting was kind of not out there. You couldn't really buy a whole lot in the way of non-voting shares, because why would you want a non-voting share of something? That's like a limited partnership ownership. You don't get a say in anything. But he did it, and that's made him a lot of money, just as a side note, because that money as an influx to Apple was what funded the iPod. And the iPod is what funded the iPhone and the iPad. Apple returned with the iMac and a lot of the other stuff that came out afterwards.
UMac?
UMac, yes. Right. iMac, UMac, WeMac.
Yeah.
So the end result of this is that there was no longer an antitrust investigation against Microsoft because they used their money, and it had to be non-voting shares, otherwise he'd have a monopoly in multiple directions. If he had voting shares of Apple after buying $100 million, he would have had near controlling interest in Apple at that point because it was so low. Now Apple is bigger than Microsoft. So one of the kind of morals of the story is that antitrust was built, the laws were built around industrial facilities. It was basically built as a target against Andrew Carnegie, who had U.S. Steel, and he had these huge manufacturing facilities that was refining and pouring and doing all this great thing with steel. And he had set it up in a way that it was going to last forever, essentially.
Who had all the oil? The Standard Oil company.
Standard Oil.
Who was that? It wasn't Carnegie. There was
no.
Anyway.
Dow was involved in that. DuPont was involved
in
that.
There was one guy who basically owned all the oil production in the United States, and they broke it up. The point is that...
And the Ma-Bell thing where then...
Antitrust goes into effect...
Rockefeller.
It's the Rockefeller
brothers,
right.
Yeah.
Antitrust goes into effect when competition is being squished out of the market, and somebody who has a majority of the market or a controlling share in a given market starts to do things that aren't just competitive but are what are called anti-competitive. In other words, they do business with us or we'll squish you.
Right. We're going to take losses on this product forever because we can afford to put you out of business.
Mm-hmm. And that is kind of the standard, it's called the Taft-Hartley Bill. It was passed in, I think, the 1920s?
Yeah, somewhere in that vicinity. Carnegie died before the antitrust movement really got the Justice Department actually finished it. It was a decades and decades long legal battle.
But there's an entire bureaucracy and a few thousand attorneys who make their money off of sniffing out sniffing out companies that are too big and making them smaller.
Right, and this is one of those areas that I think Congress has the ability to update that law. They should update that law because there's some specific areas. It's designed for the mega companies, the antitrust, the monopolies that are basically running the world, like U.S. Steel and Standard Oil did, or Bell, for that matter. And this concept of these massive corporations that are just running the world... When it comes to niche markets, it wasn't that big a danger when the antitrust laws were written. Not that big a deal. Well, it is now when you have lots and lots and lots and lots and lots, say lots a few more times, I'll say lots and more times, of small monopolies in the medicine world, where you have a company that may be the only company on the planet that's producing a given medication. And there's no competition because they've run the generic competition out of business by keeping the prices low for so long. The generic producer looks at it and says, there's no profit margin here. This is the only drug we're making, where the other company is making 80,000 different drugs. So they can take a loss on this particular drug. So the generic company stops doing that drug.
And then the company raises the price to an absurd level.
Right, thousands of percentage points.
And in many cases, by the way, when they do this, they own the patent, which is... And that's just an area... Medicine is an area that...
The government is so involved that it's not really a free market.
It's not really... It is not a free market, but at the same time, it's not well regulated.
Right. It's an unregulated... Regulation.
It's an unregulated, not free market, and it is going to have to be fixed. I mean, very frankly, the entire medical business in the United States needs an overhaul.
Yeah, and this is something I talked about this during the entire month that you were gone. I had little snippets on this. And I've just been through a process. Last week, I spent 45 minutes just talking about not knowing what you're going to be charged when you go to the hospital or go to a doctor for that matter. And the idea of not knowing is preventing people from going to the hospital when they need to. And that's a little scary. And I spent a lot of time on that the last few weeks. And then in the middle of that, on Thursday, I took my cat to the veterinarian and had the, obviously a cat is not a human. I'm sorry, I'm breaking a lot of busting a lot of bubbles out there.
There's some people who might find that controversial.
They might say they're better than humans. Some of them might say they're much worse than humans. Okay, but it's a cat. The same can be true for a dog or a ball python. You show up, the veterinarian, who is doing fairly well financially, they're driving nice cars, living fairly well, they spend a lot of time in school, they are happy with their lives. The cat had a urinary tract infection. Sorry for the extra information,
but
that can be very dangerous for cats. It can kill them very quickly. And so the vet saw us without an appointment. It was on an emergency type basis, even though we weren't sure if it was an emergency. They did a whole series of tests, prescribed medication, provided the medication. The final bill was $80. The vet is making money, has employees. The vet didn't have to pay profitable margins to an insurance company and then the insurance company's parent company and the parent company's parent company. It didn't have to deal with a big governmental organization to get paid. It didn't have to wait for the payment. The payment was given same day. So this is a free market, a true free market, where that vet could have said, hey, I'm going to charge you double that, and I would have paid it, but I probably would have gone to another vet the next time. So free markets keep prices down. If you really have a free market, then the service that's available is affordable and known quantities. And that's not what we have in the medical world right now. I'm using that comparison to say, well, people say, well, medicine is complicated. Yeah, it is. It's complicated for animals, too. And humans are obviously not animals. It's not a perfect example. It doesn't just completely transfer over. Another part of that is you got to buy insurance at the human level that's a lot tougher because you might have hundreds of thousands of dollars of malpractice insurance heading out there.
There's a fundamental reality, and I've talked to conservatives about this. I can consider myself in many ways a conservative, but they really can't get their mind around it, and that is that Medicare, the law Medicare,
yeah,
forbids doctors and hospitals from charging more to Medicare than they do to the regular patients. Therefore, whatever Medicare sets a payment.
Yeah.
Therefore, the doctor or the hospital or the clinic or the whatever is going to charge you when you go in there exactly the same thing they charge to a Medicare patient, which means Medicare is very clearly a socialist single-payer system.
And its prices have been going up,
and
that's been setting the stage for all the other prices coming up.
And it influences everything else that goes on. And the bottom line to it is, and this is, some people, everybody will probably be upset at me of this, whichever side of the political spectrum
upsetting the Democrats by calling Medicare bad, and upsetting the... I would say it's bad. It needs to be redone.
But the point is, we have a socialist system that pays, in many cases, for a hospital or a clinic or a physician, the majority of their income. And the rest of us are being batted around by that system. We have a choice. We either go to a full free enterprise system for everything and everybody, and no matter how old you are, and the government gets out of it, or, and you're not going to like this, we have a single payer for everybody with copays.
And this is
basically TRICARE.
Right. This is my sad statement on that. It looks like that's the easiest solution. This is the sad statement. Because a big reason that this problem is so big is because of Medicare.
3 minutes to your next Fox News.
Medicare existing causes these problems to be there, and the solution to the problems is to make Medicare a single payer. That just hurts to say.
Well, Medicare is a single payer.
We'll make it single payer across the board for everybody, which is dangerous because we haven't fixed the problems with Medicare.
But we have this fundamental problem in that we are not going to allow people to die because they don't have health insurance.
That's right.
And
that's
we're
the
not
law
gonna,
of the land if you have a non-profit hospital, which the vast majority of hospitals are.
But even if you have a for-profit hospital, the issue of turning away a person who's dying from the emergency room, it just isn't going to happen.
Yeah, it does. It does. They don't have a trauma care there.
Okay.
If it's a for-profit, they'll say, send it to the trauma care.
Right, but let's just say So the point is, we believe there's a moral obligation
to help
collectively
people.
That people should be able to get quality health care.
Yeah, I don't want to be on vacation somewhere in my swimming suit and get really hurt with a life-threatening something. I get hit by a car or something, get taken to the hospital. I don't have my ID with me, no proof of insurance. I might be unconscious. I certainly want them to start working on me without proof of insurance.
And the point is, we all agree, this is why it's different from other markets. There is nothing that says everybody has the right to have a car.
Right. That's not a
so
right
we have
anywhere.
Pretty much a free market in cars. We don't consider that people have a right to have airline tickets.
Correct.
We don't consider that people have a right to own a house.
Pocket watches.
So the point is that we do collectively as society agree to that people without adequate health care die, and we don't want them dying. So, for lack of health care, therefore, they should be able to get health care. The question is, how do you pay for it? And I'm going to say that every other developed country on the planet has come up with a single-payer system. Mm-hmm. My opinion, what we need to do is take a look at the level of satisfaction.
That was an overly broad statement, not every single, but
which
that's
one?
I can give you a list, but I don't have the list with me now.
Okay, that don't have a single-payer system?
That's right.
I didn't know that there were developed countries that didn't have single-payer
systems.
What
is a developed country? Because South Korea is considered a developed country and it doesn't have a single-payer system. Singapore has a single-payer system. China is considered right on the cusp.
No, it's developing.
It's developing. It does not. Russia, is that developed? No. But we could go down a list of countries. Obviously, we don't want to be in the same boat as Russia and China when it comes to medicine.
Certainly the countries that I would consider developed, civilized, industrialized countries.
Mm-hmm.
To the best of my knowledge, I didn't know that South Korea didn't have a single
industrialized place. May not be the good example of developed at
but
this
it's
point.
But it's a definition. And the point is that we're not dealing with it at all rationally. Both sides are dealing with it emotionally. And it's going to take somebody with a lot of courage to say, let's throw this thing open to debate and let's figure out how we can get everybody health care in the most efficient way. And I think the easiest solution is to take a look at the countries that already have systems and say, where do we have the greatest level of satisfaction and the greatest level of efficiency? And by the way, you find that basically the Scandinavian countries are the places where Scandinavia, Germany, England, or United Kingdom, rather, they are generally quite much happier with their system. They spend considerably, like a third less of their GDP on medical expenses. And this is the really fascinating thing. They have a longer life expectancy and a lower disease rate in those countries while spending a third less than we do. That means that we need to take a serious look at our system and come up with a better solution. And it's going to be a big deal. It's going to take a major issue. It's going to have to happen. But it's going to happen because fundamentally the cost of medical, the medical expenses in the United States are rising so much faster than inflation that eventually we won't be able to afford anything other than medical care. And everybody who's looked at it carefully, including physicians, say that it's spent in an absurd fashion where we spend, and this is a really fascinating thing, in the last couple of years of a person's life, the average patient in a hospital in the United States, the average person in the United States actually, winds up having more money spent on medical care in the last 2 years of their life than the entire rest of their life together.
Yeah.
And it doesn't extend their life expectancy.
The only country on the list that I was just looking at that doesn't have a single payer, that is industrialized and so on like us, is Ireland.
Ireland doesn't have a single payer?
No, that's correct. So whether or not it's a functional single payer or universal system is another one, because Canada's system is pretty broken. But if we compare it to the Medicare system or the VA system in the United States, I would say we're equally broken in those single payer systems. So we have to fix, if our solution to the problems of healthcare right now is a single payer system, we better fix what we have before that goes into effect, or a lot of people are going to be just as unsatisfied with a single payer system as they are with this. We may know what the bill's going to be, but we might not too. If you have Medicare and you show up for a doctor's appointment, you don't know what you're going to pay either.
You know what the copays are.
There's copays, and then there's other than copays.
Oh.
Do you have ABC on your Medicare? Because, if you show up for the hospital and you have a hospital stay, you know what you're going to pay, which is just the copays.
I'd say.
But when it comes to even prescription drug care, when it comes to your physician visit, the copays are changing. The premiums are changing. The amount that you pay for any transactional event changes regularly. So we have to fix. We can't just, the Democrats' solution to the medical problem is single payer. We'll base it on Medicare. And that's a nightmare. That's as bad or worse as the Canadian system. The Republicans really don't have a solution, as they've shown again and again and again. So no solution or bad solution is where we need to get Democrats and Republicans talking together to recognize,
they talk together. They yell at each other all the time.
Yeah, there's beeping happening constantly if it's on public television because they can't air those words. We need to get actually fixing the problems together. It's like having a house where the plumbing is broken.
That's like having cats and dogs to clear a peace treaty.
Right.
It won't work.
The plumbing is broken in the house. One person's solution is to leave it broken. The other one's solution is to knock down the house. And I'm kind of going, well, guys, there are ways of doing this. And it starts with...
Doing commercials,
yeah. So we got to play some commercials. I want to hit one more thing before we go. Salado's Chocolate and Wine Festival is this weekend. Just the words, chocolate and wine, should cause you warm feelings and happiness. Salado Montessori, which is a not-for-profit Montessori school in Salado, is running the grape stomp.
It is a very great grape stomp.
And that's worth going just for that. There's an I Love Lucy look-alike competition. They're recommending that you bring your old white gowns, either prom or this is all female side of things. I don't have any old white
gowns.
You
don't have a white prom gown?
I obviously missed something important in my life by not having that. But they're getting all dressed up and stomping on grapes together. And how can that not be a good thing to do on the weekend? When was the last time you stomped on some grapes on purpose?
There were a bunch of grapes on a path once, and I was walking along, and they were...
When was that?
It's been a few years.
A few years being...
I don't know.
Decades?
A few decades, years. What's the difference?
Yeah. So, anyway, it is... the grape stomp starts at 4, and goes through 7, I think, all the way to the end of the 7 o'clock hour to 8 o'clock.
That's on Main Street in Salado.
The north end of
Main Street up near Compass Bank and this business across the street called the Personal Wealth Coach. And
so anyway, Salado, the whole weekend is going to be fun because we've got breweries, we've got beer on tap.
That's a promissory statement.
Antique shops and good food and all amazing good weather for Texas this time of year. I know it's a little bit drizzly outside, but that means that the temperature's going to be lower. It's pretty awesome.
He actually meant to say that in his opinion, he believes that the probabilities are that it will be fun.
Yes. All right. We're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the phone numbers in here are 254-773-1400, and we'll be back. With more of the Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake McClure.
We got to figure out how to do that.
Yeah. We've got a caller coming in. I've got some emails to answer. So, caller on
773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah. We all know that rebalancing portfolios periodically is important. What's your opinion on frequency, monthly, quarterly, annually, or percentage-wise when things change? I'll hang up and listen.
Jake is the expert. Well, I don't know if he's an expert.
I used to be an expert, so I am an expert.
Yeah, but he's the professional on this. He's actually done some intensive studying on this issue. So,
yeah.
Jake, take it away.
All right. There is no modern study on the timing of rebalancing that's shown any time period to be better. Now, you handing it off to me as the expert, I need to point out something else. There was a paper written about 15 years ago by another McClure who's also bald and is sitting across from me that was used by many, many people in the investment world. If you rebalanced on the first of a quarter, there was noticeable improvement in performance for your portfolio. It's not true anymore. The beginning of the quarter, the reason why, and this was stated in the paper, Jeff McClure wrote this with Carolyn Saros, who's a CPA up in Connecticut. And the idea was that it took pension funds and big endowments a long time to make a trade. So they would look at their portfolio and say, this is up and that's down. We need to sell the thing that's up and buy the thing that's down. And it would take them several days to do it, where if that's the beginning of a quarter, they're not going to get it done on the first day of the quarter. So if a small investor rebalances on that first day, they're leading those big sales. The big pension funds, when they make the sale, cause those prices to come down when they make those sales. It's not true anymore because the big pension funds can trade faster than you can and faster than I can, which says something. So there's no modern study that shows a time period as a good fundamental expression of when you're supposed to rebalance. However, depending on your portfolio and depending on a lot of other factors that have to be put in as variables, there may be methods of rebalancing the portfolio that add to the return based on the percentage off of a pre-allocated position. I know we're getting relatively technical there.
You're getting esoteric.
But the idea is...
I have an easier solution.
Go ahead with your easier one.
Easier solution is very simple. You look at the aggressiveness of your portfolio. How much is in defensive positions? How much is in aggressive positions? And you say, if the market crashed tomorrow, if 1987, October 1987 occurred in October of this year, would I be comfortable with this portfolio? And if it's too aggressive, then you need to pull it back a little bit. By 1987, I don't mean just the crash. I'm talking about the crash and the recovery, which took about 24 months. Or if it were 2000 or if it were 2007, would I be comfortable with this portfolio?
87 didn't take 24 months. 87
recovery. To get back to the same level.
Yeah, to get back to the same level was less than a year.
Well, anyway.
It was more like 8 months. It was 18 months in the Great Recession for a well-diversified portfolio where the S&P took 6 years.
Yeah, I'm talking about the S&P 500.
Right, and that
took in 1887. I think it took 24 months to get back.
I don't think so.
Anyway, the point is, if an unexpected event occurs, and in 1987, nobody, and I want to emphasize, nobody, and there's been a lot of research on this, called that one in advance. It just happened.
Kind of a flash crash of the time.
And very frankly, in 2007, there's been a lot of research into 2007. A lot of people came forward and said, yeah, we knew the mortgage problem was there. Nobody, and there's been a lot of research on this, actually came out and said, we're about to have the worst recession we've had since the Great Depression of the 1930s because the mortgage situation is so out of control. Nobody said that. Nobody knew it was going to be that bad. So the point is, at any given moment, you can have a crash, which means that if you're 100% in the S&P 500 stock index, for example, or you're 100% in some relatively aggressive position, you're going to see if in 2000 you'd been 100% in the S&P 500 and you rode that whole thing out. What was it, 18 years before you recovered after inflation?
Something like that.
No, you don't want to be there. So the point is, take a look at your portfolio. During a bull market, your portfolio will become more aggressive. And if you don't know how to look back and say, this is too much, mathematically and objectively, then you need some help. Don't go by your gut. Don't go by your gut reaction that, well, yeah, this could go on forever. By the way, I read the first "this could go on forever" the other day.
Yeah, it's
first. The chief economist at First Trust said that it could be, we could easily run another 5 years or 10 years before we have another recession. He officially said that, which means this could go on forever is finally
starting to be the standard statement. Yeah.
And you had some emails.
Some emails, and I want to address them. One of them I'll address more in the coming weeks. A couple of them came in calling me to task, as it should be. I wasn't being completely balanced. One email from Ken said, there are Republicans with solutions to healthcare problems. It's not correct that they do not have any. Here's the problem with that. It's not a solution in any way that can be agreed on by more than about six people. And you got to have more than six votes to get this thing fixed. So my suggestion that Republicans need to talk to Democrats, they need to talk to Republicans as well, because the Republicans' own worst enemies are themselves at the moment. They're ripping into each other. This happens just like we talk about market cycles. This happens in the cycle of majority rule. When the Democrats had both the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they considered other Democrats their biggest enemies. And the Republicans are in that boat right now. They're looking at each other, whether it's the Freedom Caucus or the Tea Party, or the Republicans are fighting amongst themselves. The fact that we got, did you see this? A budget was passed?
Yes.
Now, whether or not the president vetoes it because it doesn't include funding for the
wall,
there's no wall in it. And I have to, not that the president's going to listen to this program, but I have to remind him, this is in no way a stop to the presidential promise. When he was running in the campaign, he was very clear on who pays for the wall, and it was not the U.S. Congress. So I don't know why he would stop Congress from doing this, because his campaign promise was Mexico pays for the wall. So hopefully he doesn't veto this, because then we'll have a government shutdown right before elections. That's not going to be good for the Republicans. So that's my last piece here. Reasons for life expectancy is another one. There are reasons for life expectancy in the United States to be lower than in other countries besides health care.
I don't know what they are.
Well, they are. There's diet. There is obesity. There's opioids. There are a lot of reasons why we have different mortality rates than, say, Denmark. But the infant mortality rate.
Yeah, the infant mortality rate of Ghana, a third world country, developing country in Africa. The infant mortality rate is lower than it is in the United States. That means we have something wrong with our system.
Yeah, and the reason for that infant mortality difference is that there's better coverage or better medical care for the low-income area in Ghana. Now, I'm not suggesting that we have some socialized system to take care for everyone. I think the solution is going to be a better one than that if we can actually work together. I think that there are ways of getting the system to work better, and the first is to look at Medicare, which is it's paying out more than it's receiving into the fund and has been for quite some time. It's going to go belly up at some point. We've got to fix it anyway. Let's fix it from the ground up. Let's make it work and make it be something reasonable that people look at and know what they're getting. I think Medicare is something that's been promised for enough people that if we just get rid of it, you're going to have a minor revolt.
Well, we can't get rid of it at this point.
It would destroy the system that we have for medicine at the moment.
We need a complete overhaul, not just to get rid of this or add something else
right.
or put a Band-Aid on it.
We need to look at where the government is touching health care to begin with, and it's touching health care in so many places. It's got fingers in almost every pie, and we need to very carefully say, what business does the government have in this when it's distorting it and making it more expensive rather than less expensive?
And you mentioned Denmark a minute ago. Denmark has certain warts and pimples like any other nation.
Yeah, it is definitely a socialist country.
But
they're happy, but they're socialist.
You also have some, it's like Sweden is definitely a socialist country, but it's got Volvo and it's got
yeah.
Ericsson and it's got a bunch of very, very, very
Denmark
capitalist.
Denmark has Merck, which is it's one of the biggest shipping companies in the world. Anybody on the port sees that name written on the cargo containers and on the big cargo ships.
So it's not a matter of socialist versus capitalist. It's a matter of what system. It's a matter of pragmatist. What systems, and I really think this is the way to do it. You can look around the world and people have experimented with different medical delivery systems, different paying systems, and some of them have produced happy doctors, happy patients, and wonderful success rates at a very much reduced cost to what we're paying in the United States. And I think that should be our starting point. And without regard to saying whether it's socialist or capitalist
or just say what works, what's caused people to have good health care and hasn't squelched research.
You know, for example,
we need to keep doing research. There needs to be profits involved. Obviously, that needs to happen or people won't do it.
And to put this in perspective, for those of you who say you're just going to claim socialism works, yeah, I can tell you that socialism works in some areas, and it works very, very well, and I'll say that because there was a lot of experimentation over the years in military, hiring mercenaries, which is very capitalist, versus having a socialist armed forces. We have an absolutely socialist armed force. You get paid according whether you work or don't work. You get free medical care. You look at the armed forces of the United States. There is absolutely, as a matter of fact,
it is a merit-based socialism.
But it is against, well, sort of.
Sort of. Sort of. Unless you're in,
with
you know,
seniority and
yeah,
all of the
yeah,
kinds
if
of
you're the same rank as someone else, they've been doing it a lot
right.
longer, but you're better at it. Well, the longer you did it, if you're the same rank, you have higher
But the
rank.
Point is that it is actually against the law, except under certain very special circumstances, for a person in the military to engage in capitalism.
Right.
And
in fact, an officer that writes a book while in active duty, that the proceeds of that book go to the U.S. government, not to the officer.
The point I'm trying to make is that there are some areas where socialism works really, really well, and there are some areas where it doesn't work at all, and we need to back off and stop being radical whatever we are, and say what works.
Let's reach to the middle, guys.
Somebody
Otherwise,
said,
we don't get anything done.
I was asked the other day, what is your political alignment? I said, I'm a pragmatist. Can I hit on something? We only
yeah.
got about three
yeah.
and a half minutes.
And
left.
We
got
to hit Solito Chocolate and Wine one more time as well. Go ahead.
Okay, two things. Number one, we are in the peak of the economic growth cycle right now, and there is a cycle. Cycles occur in economic systems just like they do in the weather. I can tell you with a great deal of certainty that at some point it's going to cool off here in Central Texas, and it's actually going to get cold at some point. And I can tell you it's coming, but I can't tell you exactly when. I can tell you that we are in the peak of an economic cycle. The economy is running hotter than it can sustain, which means there's going to be a downturn. When? There seems to be kind of a consensus it's going to be among economists around 2020. But it is going to happen. Be prepared for it. Also be aware that
sometime,
at the top
yeah.
of an economic cycle, There is a tendency to become irrationally exuberant and to invest in things that later you wish you hadn't invested in. That's number one. Number two, there is a serious long-term problem. And when you go to the polls in November, you want to think about this just a moment. The government ran a $214 billion deficit last month.
For the month?
A year ago, it was $107 billion.
Both of those are bad. The second, this one that we did this year is worse.
I don't know that 107 is bad when you consider is the fact that the economy is growing faster than that. The point is, the deficit, we just passed a tax cut and increased government spending dramatically. And the president promised that somehow it would all be made up with increased revenues. No, the government's revenues on taxes so far this year is down substantially from last year, and there's no suggestion it's going to do anything else. So we got two different issues that are going on here.
Revenue across the board is down about 20% as of the end of August. Feds collected a record individual income tax return. So individuals, we had a revenue increase of 1% over the year before, which is great. We lowered taxes for individuals and revenue went up. We lost enough in the other areas that it didn't keep up. We're down.
And the tariff revenue, by the way, is such a tiny piece of the total government revenue that it's insignificant.
All right. We're about out of time. Sorry about all the extra stuff we had to talk about. Salado Chocolate and Wine Weekend is this weekend. Check out the Grape Stomp at the north end of Main Street. Check out the chocolate. Check out the wine. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we have local numbers available as voicemails during the weekend, real-life people during the week at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts and so on of our prior episodes. You can email us directly at Jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com, and we do read those emails. You have anything to wrap up with in the last 10 seconds or so, 15
nope.
seconds?
Nope.
All right. Well, have a fantastic weekend. Hopefully we'll see you at the Salado Chocolate and Wine stuff. I'll be out there doing sound. Till next week, this is the Personal Book.